Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I just want to thank you all for coming tonight, and also thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. Well, we're honored tonight to have Adam Johnson here with his novel, The Orphan Master's Son. As I'm sure all of you know, Adam Johnson won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for this work of genius. The book was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, as well as named one of the best books of the year by the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, and a host of other newspapers and publications. His earlier books include Parasites Like Us and Emporium, a collection of short stories, both of which we have on the bookshelf over here. Adam Johnson teaches creative writing at Stanford University. Will you please join me in welcoming Adam Johnson? Thank you.
Yes, thanks for coming out tonight. I know it's rainy. I know it's a Saturday night, and you have important, interesting things to do. You're probably missing great dinners and martinis and things like that. But maybe you care about books and your bookstore. Speaking of which, this is an amazing space. I came to the Tattered Cover many years ago when I was like a young beginning writer, and it was, you know, not this location. And this is like going to church. And, you know, I do travel around America and read at a lot of places. And not every community is, you know, lucky to have a center, you know, a cultural center like this where readers and writers connect. And so thank you, Tattered Cover, for having me come through. Hey, Stephen. My old friend from my PhD program, Stephen Graham Jones, is there. We saw each other at the Winter Institute in New Orleans this year. And there's Curtis Lee, whom I met at the Pulitzer event in Columbia. When was it? In April?
May.
And Curtis won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the Aurora shooting here in town. So you probably know him better than I do. I was maybe just going to read for a little bit, not too much. I don't want to bore anyone. Maybe just 20 minutes or so. And I'd love to just field questions then. People are curious about North Korea and about writing, and I'd be happy to, you know, share any knowledge that I gained in researching that place with you. How's that sound?
Yeah.
Okay. Has anyone here been to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea? Is anyone here a scholar on North Korea? Okay. Has anyone seen Team America World Police, in which the Kim Jong-il puppet dances and sings I'm So Lonely? Okay. Remind me to tell you a story about a North Korean who saw that clip on YouTube. Okay, I was just going to read... read from deeper in the book. I chose this selection because it's in the first person, and I think, you know, sometimes listeners can connect to a first-person voice a little better, perhaps. Our character is in Pyongyang, and he likes to think of himself as an interrogator, not a torturer. He doesn't like that term. So we're in Pyongyang. The main character in the book is Commander Ga, but he's just a minor character in the corner. And this is deep in the book. It won't make any sense to you. So just let go. Don't try to understand it. Just kick back and see what happens. For 10 hours, I interrogated Commander Ga, but I could trick him into revealing nothing. Instead of confessing to killing the actress and her children, he only said that they flew away on a big bird to a land of make-believe. "If you don't talk to me," I told Commander Gaw, "the Poobyok will get their turn at you." Commander Gaw had a tattoo of this actress on his chest. It was large and deeply inked. He clutched it. "I'm not afraid of pain," he said. "The first thing the Poobyok will do to you," I told him, "is take that pretty picture from you." Commander Gaw was dehydrated. He struggled to swallow. "You can't separate the two of us," he said. "The actress and I, we have no secrets. We have shared everything." His was the toughest citizen biography I'd ever tried to write, but I'd get him to talk eventually. If it was one thing we had no shortage of here in North Korea, it was forever. I hung up my smock at Division 42 and made haste for the subway, hoping to make it home before Pyongyang's power went out for the night. The Kwangbok station, with its beautiful murals of Lake Samji, was my stop. Urchin girls grilled green onion tails on the sidewalk while old-timers played ghost stop in the twilight. On the streets, I bartered Commander Gaw's military medals for cucumbers and sesame paste. Apartment lights slowly came to life, and you could see that no one lived above the ninth floor of their apartment buildings. The elevators never worked, and if they did, the power was bound to go out and trap you between floors. My building was the glory of Mount Paektu, and I lived on the 22nd floor, a height that made sure my elderly parents never went out unattended. Inside, I cooked them dinner. When they tasted the food, they praised Kim Jong-il for its flavor. And when I asked after their day, they said it certainly wasn't as hard as the day of the dear leader Kim Jong-il, who carried the fate of the people on his back. You see, their eyesight failed at the same time, and ever since, they've become paranoid that there might be someone around they can't perceive, ready to report them for anything they say. They listen to the loudspeaker all day, and are careful never to reveal a personal feeling, lest it get them denounced by a stranger they can't quite lay their eyes on. The next day, a citizen was apprehended with a cellular telephone, which he claimed Commander Gaw had given him for safekeeping. The battery was long since dead, and I couldn't help thinking that all of Commander Gaw's secrets were stored inside. That was nonsense, what he said about having no secrets. Even as I strapped my subjects into the autopilot and cranked up the electricity, even when it didn't matter anymore, they kept on confessing. I opened and closed that phone. How could I get it to talk? My parents' vision had become so bad that when I arrived home, I had to tell them that night had fallen. I helped them to their cots, placed side by side near the stove. They stared at the ceiling with their blank eyes. My father's eyes had gone white, but my mother's were clear and expressive. I sometimes suspected that maybe her vision wasn't as ruined as his. "Mother, father," I said, "I have to go out for a while." My father said, "May the everlasting wisdom of Kim Jong-il guide you." "Obey the curfew," my mother said. I had Commander Gaw's wedding ring and his mobile phone in my pocket. "Mother," I said, "can I ask you a question?" "Yes, son." "How come you never found a bride for me?" "Our first duty is to country," she said, "then to leaders, then to..." I know," I said, "then to the party and to the charter of the workers' assembly and so on, but I was in the youth brigade. I studied Juche ID at Kim Il-sung University. How come I have no wife?" "You sound troubled," my father said. I saw the fingers twitch on his right hand. When I was a boy, one of his gestures was to reach out with that hand and ruffle my hair. That's how he would reassure me when we saw neighbors being transported or executions in the soccer stadium. So I knew that he was still in there, that despite the distemper of his patriotism, my father was still my father. Outside, on Sununju Street, even in the dark, I could see that troops of Juche girls had chalked the sidewalks with revolutionary slogans. I headed for the Raegwondong district, where long ago the Japanese built slums to house the most defiant Koreans. That's where there's an illegal night market at the base of the abandoned Rigyong Hotel. Crossing the Palgal Bridge, pipes were dumping sewage from the pastel housing blocks, and in the water, shit-streaked pages of the Rodong Shinmun newspaper spread like gray lily pads. The illegal deals took place near the rusted elevator shafts. A few sellers didn't like the looks of me, but one was willing to talk. He was young, and his ear had been notched by a Pubyok agent. I handed him Commander Gaw's phone. He pulled the battery, licked its contacts, then checked the internal card. "This is good," he said. "What do you want for it?" "I'm not selling it," I said. "I need a charger for the thing." I showed him Commander Gaw's wedding ring. He laughed. "Unless you're selling the phone, get out of here," he said. Several years ago, after an April 15th ceremony, the local Pubyok squad got drunk at Division 42, and I took the opportunity to lift one of their badges. I pulled this out now and let it gleam in the dark. "I said I need a phone charger," I told him. "Let me see this," he said, and he took the badge, feeling its power. "You'll get your phone charger," he said, "but keep the ring. I trade for this." The phone charged all night, its little light still glowing yellow as my parents cooked breakfast. Morning news from the loudspeaker had them depressed. There'd been a big story about poverty and starvation in South Korea. "Luckily, the dear leader's sending them food aid," my father said. "I hope they can hang on to reunification." It was while we were eating our porridge that the phone's light turned green. I toyed with the device, scrolling through the menus. My father heard its funny beeps and tones. "Have you got something there?" he asked. "No," I told him. For a moment, it felt like my mother glanced at the phone, but when I looked up, she was staring straight ahead. I passed it back and forth before her eyes. Then I returned to the keypad. I tried to think of someone to call. A friend, a colleague, a woman. Did I have no one in my life? "Father," I said, "if you were to contact someone, who would it be?" "Why would I contact anyone?" he asked. "I have no need." "Well, it's not need," I said. "Wouldn't you want to call a friend or a relative?" "Our party comrades fulfill all of our needs," my mother said. "What about your aunt?" I asked my father. "Don't you have an aunt in South Korea?" My father's face was blank. "We have no ties to that capitalist nation," he said. My mother said, "We denounce her." "I'm not asking as a state interrogator," I told him. "I'm your son. This is just family talk." I returned to the phone, moving through its functions, all of which seemed disabled. It looked like I'd be selling the thing after all. "But wait," I said. "When I was a boy, you used to play cards with a couple from the factory. Aren't you curious what happened to them? Wouldn't you contact them if you could?" "I don't believe we've heard of these people," my mother said. "I'm sure of it," I told her. "I remember them clearly." "No," she said, "you're mistaken." "Mother, it's me. There's no one else in the room. No one's listening to this." "Stop this dangerous talk," my father said. "We met with no one." I reached to take his hand, but the touch surprised him, and he recoiled. "Father, it's me, your son. Take my hand," I said. "Is this a test?" he asked me. He looked white-eyed around the room. "Are we being tested?" There's a talk that every father has with his son, in which he brings the child to understand that there are things we must say on the outside, while inside we're still family. I was 8 when my father had this talk with me. We were under a tree on Moranbang Hill. He told me that there was a path set out for us. On it, we had to do everything the signs commanded and heed the announcements along the way. We must walk this path alone on the outside, but inside we would be holding hands. On Sundays, the factories were closed, so the air was clear that day, and I could imagine this path ahead stretching across the Taedong Valley. We were eating berry-flavored ices and listening to the sounds of old men at their changi boards. My father said to me, "I denounce this boy for having a blue tongue." And we laughed at that. I pointed at my father. "This citizen eats mustard," I said. I'd recently tried mustard for the first time, and the look on my face had made everyone laugh. My father addressed an invisible authority in the air. "This boy has counter-revolutionary thoughts about mustard? He should be sent away to correct his mustardly thinking." And we laughed. "Now take my hand," he told me. and I put my small hand in his, and then his mouth became sharp with hate. He snapped, "I denounce this citizen as an imperialist puppet who should be remanded to stand trial for crimes against the state. His face was red and venomous. I've witnessed this boy spew capitalist diatribes in an effort to poison our minds with this traitorous filth." The old men turned from their game to stare at us. I was terrified, at the edge of crying, and my father said, "See, my mouth said that, but my hand, it was holding yours. If your mother must ever say something like that to me, in order to protect the two of you, know that inside, she and I are holding hands. And if someday you must say something like that to me, I will know it's not the real you. Inside is where the father and son will always be holding hands." And he reached out and ruffled my hair. At work, I took all of my frustrations out on Commander Gah, interrogating him relentlessly, but he only begged for the can of peaches he'd been carrying when we arrested him. "What's so special about these peaches?" I asked, and I studied the can. I myself hadn't had a peach since they closed the factory after botulism killed half of Nampo. We had waterboarded Commander Gah over and over. "Bowl" is all he could manage to say, and "spoon." That night, I felt weak, like my body was hungering for some kind of food I'd never run across. I thought of the dogs in the Central Zoo that lived only on cabbage and old tomatoes. When I turned to go home, I found the subway shut down, and the queue for the Quang Bok Express bus was 3 blocks long. I started walking. I didn't make it 2 blocks before I heard the bullhorns and knew I was in trouble. The Minister of Mass Mobilization was sweeping up any citizen unlucky enough to be out on the street. You couldn't run. If they even thought you were trying to avoid volunteering for harvest duty, it was off to a redeemability farm. It was, however, the kind of thing that a Pubyok badge could get you out of. Without it, I found myself in the back of a dump truck headed to the countryside to pull rice for 16 hours. We drove northeast by moonlight toward the silhouetted Myoyang Range, the driver flashing on his headlamps when he thought he saw something in the road, but there was nothing in the road, no people, no cars, nothing but empty highways lined with tank traps. In the dark, we found a peasant village somewhere along the Chongcheng River. Us city folk, about 30 of us, climbed down to sleep on the open ground. I had my smock to keep me warm. For 5 years, I'd used a badge to escape these harvest details, so I'd forgotten the sounds of crickets in the summer, the pungent mist that rises off rice water. I heard children playing in the dark and the sounds of a man and a woman engaged in what must have been genital intercourse. What followed was my best night of sleep in years. There was no breakfast, and my hands blistered before the sun was fully up. Why we drained one field and flooded another, I had no idea, but light dawned hard on the peasants of Chigang province. They all wore cheap, ill-fitting Vinalon clothes. Their bodies were rail-thin, their teeth translucent to the black cores. In the afternoon, a city woman was struck by a grand snake, long as a man. I tried to quiet her screams by stroking her hair, but that snake bite must have done something to her. She started hitting me and pushing me away. The peasants caught the twisting snake, black as the befecaled water that had concealed it. Some wanted to take its gallbladder. Others wished to milk its venom for liquor. I tried to convince them to free the snake, arguing that another black snake must be out there somewhere, waiting for this broad swimmer to make its way home. It was midnight before I made it home. Though the key turned in the lock, the door wouldn't open. It was somehow barricaded from within. I pounded on the door. "Mama," I called. "Father, it's me, your son. There's something wrong with the door." But eventually I buttoned my smock and I lay down in the hall. I thought of the peasants with their children and their loud intercourse, of how, except for starvation, they didn't have a care in the world. In the dark, Commander Gah's phone lit and beeped. On its tiny screen, I discovered a picture. There was a Korean woman and her children, and they stood smiling against a sunny blue sky. They wore black caps with ears that made them look like mice. Come morning, the door was standing open. Inside, my mother was cooking porridge while my father sat at the table. "Who's there?" my father asked. "It's me, father, your son." "Thank goodness you're back," he said. "We were worried about you." My mother said nothing. At work, I had pulled my parents' secret files, trying to find clues as to why they were so difficult. Getting information out of strangers was easy, not so with my parents. Now, on the table, I could see those files had been rifled. "The door was blocked last night," I said. "Didn't you hear me calling?" "I didn't hear anything," my father said. "Wife, did you hear anything?" "Nothing," she said from the stove. I straightened the files. "I suppose you two have gone deaf now as well." My mother shuffled to the table with bowls of porridge. I asked, "But why, then, was the door blocked?" "You two aren't afraid of me, are you?"
"Afraid of you?" my mother asked.
"If you must know, the loudspeaker said the American Navy was conducting aggressive military exercises off the coast. When it comes to the Americans," my father said, "you can't take any chances." They blew on their food and took quiet spoonfuls. "How is it," I asked my mother, "that you can cook so well without your eyesight?" She said, "As the food cooks, the smell changes." In my mother's secret file was a photo of her young. She was a beauty, perhaps the reason she was brought to the capital from the countryside, but what got her sentenced to a factory rather than assigned as a singer or a hostess was not in her record. I ruffled the folders in the air. "Oh, there were some papers on the table," my father said, and his voice was nervous. Yes, they fell to the floor," my mother said, "but we picked them up." "It was an accident," my father said. "Oh, accidents happen," I told them. "Those papers," my mother asked, "were they work-related?" "Yes," my father said. "Were they part of a case you're working on?" "Just research," I told them. "But they must be important files if you brought them home," my father said. "Is anyone in trouble? Perhaps someone we know?" "What's going on here?" I asked them. "Is this about Mrs. Kwok? Are you still mad at me for having her sent to a labor farm? She was caught red-handed stealing coal from the furnace. You know the rules." "Don't get mad," my mother said. "We were just showing concern for the unlucky souls in your files." "Unlucky?" I asked. "What makes you call them unlucky?" They both went silent. I waved my mother's file once before her eyes, yet she made no track of it. Then I fanned her with the paper. When the breeze moved across her face, she recoiled, inhaling. "What is it?" my father asked. "What just happened?" She said nothing. "Can you see me, mother?" I said. "It's important that I know if you can see me." She faced my direction, though her eyes were without focus. "Can I see you?" she asked me. "I see you as I first saw you, in glimpses, through darkness." "Spare me the riddles," I warned her. "I have to know the truth." "You were born at night," she said to me. "I labored all day, and when darkness fell, we had no candles. You came by feel into your father's hands." My father lifted his hands, scarred by machine looms. "These hands," he said. "Such was the year Juche 62, my mother said. "Such was life in a factory dormitory. Your father lit match after match. One after another," he said, "until they were gone." "I touched every part of your body," my mother told me. "At first, to see if you were whole, and then to know you. You were so new, so innocent. You could have become anyone. It took a while, until first light, that we got a look at what we had created." "I need to be able to trust you," I told her. "I cannot have you lying to me." But she ignored this. "Our eyes do not work. That's the answer to your question. But then as now, we do not need sight to see what you've become." And I'll just pause it there. That scene gets dark and unhappy after this, and it's better to read the happy part when the family's all together. I'd be happy to discuss the book, any things you're curious about, talk about
the country of North Korea or writing about it? Any inquiries you have? Yes, sir. Yeah, sure.
North Korea.
Yeah.
So I'm suspecting that it has something to do with orphans and how they're treated as far as risky or, you know, occupations, et cetera. And did that eventually morph into the novel? Or?
Yes, yes. What's the genesis of the book is the question. When I started the book, I had not been in the best American short stories, and I thought, wouldn't it be cool to be in the best North Korean short story anthology? Like state-sponsored. All you had to do was glorify the regime. You know, I can't say I set out to write a book about North Korea. I just became fascinated as a reader. I teach a class at Stanford about reading novels as writers, how they're constructed, what maneuvers have what effects, what can we steal from good writers to improve our own. And I always throw one memoir in there so that as writers try to write fake versions of fictional people and pretend novels, we can look at how a real person wrote about his or her own life to kind of calibrate us. And I picked a book called The Aquariums of Pyongyang by a man named Kang Chol Won. And I hadn't read it. I just threw it on the syllabus and read it with the students, and it just blew us all away. It was about Kang's 9 years in Camp 15, which is Yodok, in North Korea. He entered as a 9-year-old, and he got out at 18 in a very unlikely way. April 15th is Kim Il-sung's birthday, of course. He was born April 15th, 1912, at the same time the Titanic sank. And actually, in North Korean mythology, this great failure of the West is the occasion of his birth. They actually write about those two things in one sentence. But once a year, in honor of that, they commute one family from each prison. And so that's how Kang got out to tell his story. The two big prisons, 14 and 15, in North Korea are family prisons. The way they transfer terror from the regime to the individuals through the family. So if one person in your family commits an infraction against the state, the kids, the grandparents, the brothers and sisters, usually 9 is the magic number, 9 people go. And I try to capture some of that paranoia, how that gets into a family in actually this selection. So Kang was a 9-year-old. He never even learned who in his family did what wrong, because there's no trial and there's no sentence. The assumption is that everyone works until they die. When you go into Camp 15, and there are 50,000 people in that particular prison, and it's real. It's on the other side of the world, and it's morning there, and they're just getting up. The men go to work in the mines, where the life expectancy is 6 months. The men also do lots of timber work, which is a better calling. The women make uniforms, military uniforms. There's a soy sauce distillery and a liquor distillery. That's what they do all day. The old people go into a special sub-prison called the Respect for Elders Furniture Factory, where they make furniture until they die. And Kang, at the time, was on a special child detail, because even if you're 9, you don't get out of work. You know this drug Taxol, or tamoxifen, that's been synthesized to... It's an estrogen-like drug. At the time, they had to extract it from U-bark, and North Korea had a big business getting Taxol for the world market. So if you were taking Taxol in the 80s, you know, there was a possibility that a child in a camp in North Korea had stripped the bark. So that's what he wrote about doing all day. This is a long-winded answer to your question. But I guess I didn't know anything about Korea, is what I realized. And I didn't know that gulags were alive and well in the world today. I didn't know anything about the Korean War beyond like a TV show. And it was a very serious war that, you know, our country had fought that I don't think we've come to terms with in any way at all. And just over the course of a year, I obsessively began reading just as a curious reader. And I read very quickly a dozen books. And at the end of that first year, two things happened. I started reading North Korean propaganda, and I realized they translate everything into English, including their newspapers. And they put them online every day. And I started reading the North Korean version of reality. And if you Google KCNA, the Korea Central News Agency, you can read the headlines of the Rodong Sinmun, which is the Workers' Party newspaper. I read them every morning. And you can read their version of reality, too. I can talk about what their headlines are, if you like, in a minute. And the other thing that happened to me is after I discovered their state-sponsored narrative, and I was like, what's it like to write an official narrative? And I began asking, what if I was born there as a writer? Or as a father? Or what would I do there? And the other thing is I discovered that the testimonials of defectors had started coming online. And I quit the books. I didn't care what other people's analysis of North Korea was. I just started devouring the stories of people who'd made it out. And they were unlike any stories I'd read, probably other than Rwanda. You know, I've read a lot of narratives about Rwanda. And so, you know, when someone puts a story in your hand like that, a story of their life, it's much heavier than you'd thought it would be. And it's something heavy you carry around. And you have to carry it around forever or do something with it, you know. And I just started writing. Yeah. I promise the next answer will be short. Yeah. Yes, sir.
The
speaker mentioned that I have a piece of fiction. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a piece of fiction in Esquire this month that's about personal drones, and everyone has personal drones and Google glasses. And there's a good sex scene, don't you think? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, a well-constructed sex scene. Someone is paralyzed from the neck down. One of the two persons. There is a drone who is part of. I guess it's not a three-way. Don't be sick. I teach in Palo Alto and I live in San Francisco, and there's this kind of corridor of high tech. That story kind of came out of that. Actually, a friend of mine from college took his life just before I wrote that story. And it was really about, you know, what's your relationship to someone who chooses to no longer be in this world, is what I was kind of working through there. But I did see the world much differently after studying North Korea for a while, and especially after traveling there. Yes. Oh, what a great question. Did I speak to a bunch of North Koreans, or did I read their stories online? I would say, for the most part, I read their stories online. And the stories come from four places. And I encourage you to just, I'll give you homework. Yeah, your homework is to just go read the story of one North Korean. You can go on Link, and they have very short stories, but they have people's pictures there, which I think make it very real. Because there's a diplomatic impasse with helping North Korea in any way, and because it's almost impossible to help North Korea because the military steals everything that's given to them. It's called Sung-gun policy, military first. You know, unusual entities have to help. One is missionaries. And Christian missionaries, Baptists, and Presbyterians are doing the most risky work in the world across the Yalu and Tumen rivers. And they're putting people's stories online to, you know, for their own aims, but just to build awareness. NGOs, aid workers. But something really interesting was that when the North Koreans finally make it to South Korea, and it's quite a journey I could speak to if people want to know more. Usually it takes them a year. For Kang Chol-hwan, who I mentioned, he had to escape from a gulag. He was pardoned, actually. Then you have to get out of North Korea, and increasingly making it out of southern China is the hardest of the three, really. It usually takes people a year because you have to go to Mongolia or to Southeast Asia. You have to cross the Mekong River. To get to freedom. But when they make it to South Korea, People are fairly, their eyes are opened during that year that they travel, but still they're going to the most sophisticated city in the region, I would say. North Korea's a place, they haven't invented the stoplight yet. You know, they don't have a phone book. Not that they would publish it, but technologically it's like traveling back in time to go there. The Soviets built a lot of factories there in the 60s, and the North Koreans can keep them going, but can't improve them. So there's a famous refrigerator factory that makes brand new refrigerators from 1963. And everywhere you go, people have brand new ancient refrigerators that look like giant coffins. And their main work truck is the Sungli 58, which is a truck that's brand new from 1958. So it's like going to Cuba or something in a time capsule. But when they make it to South Korea, they go to a facility called Hanawon. And now it's many facilities because there's so many defectors. It's 2013. In 2011, there were 2012, there were 1,500, I think, and 2,000 the year before who made it to Hanawon. But it's a facility that they think they're going back to jail. They have to live in it. But it's a place where they're given psychological help. Their number one expense is orthopedic dentistry. They're given, because they've never seen a dentist, they're given medical help. And they have workshops of defectors that have transitioned and they come back. And they try to wrap their heads around ideas of like paying for your food, paying for rent. And crime is unheard of in North Korea. No one would risk their lives to steal something, you know, when they're all trying to survive together. And they're especially predated upon in South Korea because they get money from the government. So they must live in this facility 3 to 4 months to help them because they do so poorly. They end up as homeless, outcasts. One thing is that in North Korea, in the countryside, you're not educated at all. You're indoctrinated. And you spend your youth memorizing speeches by Kim Il-sung. And none of this is of value when you get out into a capitalist world where you must move on your own initiative. But in Hanawon, they make a dossier on everyone. And they take the life story. And right now they've got 24,000 people have come through Hanawon so far. So these people escape from the countryside, and we actually know a great deal about what it's like to be a peasant in rural North Korea. It's Pyongyang, where the elites live, where life is good, that they don't leave. And that's the mystery. But the first person I talked to who was from North Korea had been a veteran, had been an orphan. And his particular story was so powerful that all I knew when I started was that my character would be an orphan. But, you know, I'm a writer, a dad, a teacher. I'm not an activist, you know, and I'm not out there working with defectors. I let other people take those stories for me. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. It's quite a primitive nuclear industry. It's also quite a national priority. But there are two North Koreas. The country's shaped like this. Here's Pyongyang, right down here by the DMZ. And then, you know, then there's this whole middle of the country. And then there's the border up here. And then the farther away you get from the capital, the more dangerous your life is. And you'd think in a totalitarian government, everything would be controlled. But really, when you get far away, it's kind of like the Wild West, actually. When the famine hit in the 90s, and we don't know how many people died. Some people say 5% of the population, some people say 10%. They didn't die in Pyongyang. Those people had food. They died in the countryside. And, you know, the farther you live away, and Chongjin is actually the farthest city from the capital, and it's the most dangerous city in North Korea. The famine wiped that city out, actually. But when you get out here, basic things like fuel for heating, shoes, soap, tools are very rare. Food is very difficult. And when stress hits the countryside, people have to do things to survive, like cross their no-travel zones that they're restricted to, cross the border if they're able to, scavenge old factories and strip them, barter. All these things can get your family into trouble. And so it's from the countryside that people defect. And in fact, two-thirds of all defectors come from this single province, North Hamgyong, where Chongjin is. So we have a really skewed portrait of North Korea. We only have the stories of the people who are desperate enough to leave and have the gumption to do it. Because the people you leave behind pay the price for it, the ultimate price. And almost all of them come from the rural, most dangerous part. So this North Korea, these folks don't know anything. There's one story. There's no magazines. There's no radio other than the state version. They're full indoctrination, work their lives completely under party control. But in the capital, they live by a completely different set of rules. There's a notion called Sungbun, which is a family loyalty rating. And you would know this number more than you would know anything else in your life if you lived in North Korea. And if your Sungbun rating, which means no one in your family's ever committed a crime against the state in three generations, that your great-grandparents fought properly during the Korean War, then you're trusted enough to live in Pyongyang. And if you do something wrong, you don't go to a gulag in Pyongyang. You leave Pyongyang. But if you have a low Sungbun rating in the countryside, those are the people that go to the gulags and become laborers. You have to really mess up in Pyongyang to end up in camp 14 or 15. But in the capital, they don't have any of those rules. And I don't think they believe Juche theory at all. It's hard to know. Life is so good they don't leave. And we only have a couple dozen people who've made it out to tell their stories. And so it was hard to write about Pyongyang. It was hard to write in the first person from another culture in Pyongyang. And I wrote for a few years before I attempted to do that. But just to finish that notion off, in Pyongyang, if you live there, you have real education. You know, if you live in the countryside, the defectors all talk about when the people from Pyongyang came to their schools and lined everyone up and assessed their aptitudes for certain things, and you became a fisherman, and you became a ballerina, and you became a sawmill operator. And that's all, that was your life. But in Pyongyang, there's real education. Kim Il-sung University is a real university that produces doctors and engineers of fairly high caliber. There's Pyongyang Polytechnic, which is Kim Jong-il's pet university. If you live in the capital, you have healthcare. For what it's worth, that's a pretty big deal. In the countryside, everyone saves Rigyong beer bottles. They keep them sterile with their caps covered because they happen to fit the IV lines. And so if anyone in your family needs to go to the hospital, they grab the beer bottle. And that's what's going to be your IV. And if you don't have one ready, then you know you don't have that luxury. So in the capital, the North Koreans can't make their own cell phone network. So an Egyptian company has made it, and they publicly report. And last year, they had 1.5 million cell phone subscribers in Pyongyang, and they'll hit 2 million this year. And we don't know how many people live in Pyongyang, but we're hitting saturation, probably the same level of cell phone usage we have. So they have theater, right? Propaganda, you know, plays. But, I mean, they have real lives there, and they have real resources. And the government's also a kleptocracy that brings in lots of hard currency through various ways to fund the nuclear program. Sorry, that was a long answer. But there's so much to know about North Korea to put things in context that I want to try to give a picture that you don't normally see in American media. Yeah. In the back, yes? Okay. Yes. Thank you for the question, Marty. It was, how did I send all my characters to Texas in the middle of the book? It's a pretty unlikely maneuver, though I had a lot of fun with it. It's a complicated question. I would say, people ask me a lot, what's real in the book and what's fake? It's fiction, but it's set in a real place, and I can't tell. I would say almost all the details on the surface I've sourced from somewhere. That the dogs in the Pyongyang Zoo Dogs are illegal in Pyongyang, but the king of Swaziland gave Kim Jong-il 5 dogs. And they live in the Pyongyang Central Zoo, and they live on cabbage and tomatoes to lessen their capitalist anger. But so, like, lots of the details about cutting someone's tattoos off or things like this are sourced from the real world. We don't have official relations with the DPRK, so when we want to talk officially, we talk to the UN. And when we want to speak unofficially, the North Koreans used to fly to Governor Bill Richardson's ranch in New Mexico. And they're no longer talking there. Do people know where we talk to the North Koreans now? No one? There is a barbecue joint in New Jersey. And it is a barbecue joint. There's a great article in the New Yorker about it about 2 years ago. It's a barbecue joint slash shooting range. And if the North Koreans love anything more than guns and barbecue, you know, I've yet to see it. And, you know, there's like, hey, he's a big New Jersey guy. And they like each other. I think this guy, I don't remember his name, fell in with the North Koreans. Was it through a dentist somehow? But they, every time they come to America, they come to his place, and State Department people turn up there, and they have informal chats about things there. So I wanted to capture this, how we do talk and how we inadvertently misunderstand one another by our own mutual cultural biases. That was important. Also, to write about North Korea, there... whole focus is on hating America. They loathe Japan and South Korea, but for America, they just have a special hatred that will never be let go of, it doesn't seem like. Part of it's what we did to them in the Korean War, you know, and we can talk about that. But they've just set up their little mythology as David versus Goliath, a scrappy young communist nation where we all work together versus those fat, lazy, wasteful Americans who push the world around, but we will defeat them. So, you know, to write the book's in 3 sections. One is a kind of an objective third person in which you can trust the narration of exactly what happens to a character. One is of the interrogator, which we met. And he captures our character and attempts to extract his story as best he is able. And the third voice is of the government, who takes the story from the interrogator and twists it for the propaganda uses to glorify the state. But all three of these voices come at the same time. It's a little challenging, perhaps. But, you know, to get that propaganda voice, and you, when you read the North Korean propaganda, everything is vilification of America. But a lot of it is, you know... You know, whenever something bad happens in America, it's front page news in Pyongyang. If we have a tornado, if we have a shooting at our theater, yeah, where we go to see our capitalist movies, and then we shoot each other up. That's front page news there. As are stories about our homeless problem, our lack of health care, you know, et cetera. So to capture that perspective, I had to get this critical look at America. And there was a president at the time, his name was Bush, and he was an interesting figure to me. Though his family was from super elite Maine, and though he'd gone to the elite schools, he kind of fancied himself a cowboy. And he moved to this place called Crawford, and regardless of your politics, I think this is a we can all accept this story. He moved to this rural town where no one knew him, and he put on his cowboy hat and got his, you know, four-wheel drive vehicle, and he liked to clear brush and wear jeans and be a Texan, you know. And the North Koreans are always putting up these little Potemkin villages, these fake little towns that project everything that they hold to be true. And it seemed to me that our own president was doing this kind of at the same time. He believed these notions of American individuality and self-definition, and they were inhabited by him through a Western narrative. And I just wanted to put those two together. Yeah. And it happens about 100 pages into the book. When I got the North Koreans to Texas, and I saw Texas through a North Korean perspective, in which everything the Texans try to do is to put them at ease, to fill them with folksy, family-like relaxation and comfort, insults the North Koreans to no end. And, you know, it comes to a head when the North Koreans serve them, you know, barbecue outdoors at a picnic bench, and that, you know, that they would eat outside with their fingers amid dogs, you know, is an insult that was too much to bear. But to get to that point of the book, and I saw Americans as very alien, it gave me hope that maybe I could pull this book off. It was kind of a test for me. Can I see my own world through North Korean eyes? Yes, ma'am, in the back. This is a wonderful question. Do they have real education? Do they get things like French literature? I hope you all you have access to French literature. I hope you're reading some. This is interesting. You know, there's two parts to this question, one for the countryside and one for Pyongyang. In the countryside, there's no evidence that anyone has read a book as you would know it, a work of literary art, in three generations. And just to think about North Korea, the Japanese invade in 1910, utterly subjugate the peninsula, take 800,000 male slaves to the mainland Japan, or to Japan, to run the imperial war machine, 30,000 comfort women. They make the Korean language illegal, Korean music illegal, the Taegeum, the Gaegeum, everything. All their literature becomes illegal. That's ended by the World War II. And then there's partition of the superpowers. Then there's the Korean War that sweeps the peninsula three times. So everyone to live has to change sides. And then in the north, there's the totalitarian dictatorship. So it's been a century since the North Koreans have had their literary tradition. No one can remember what their tradition was at this point. And there's no evidence that there's an underground literary scene in the countryside of those 20,000 plus defectors that have made it out since 1953. Not one has brought a manuscript, a play, a poem, anything out. They may be writing and sharing and just speaking, just having a voice, articulating their experience, but we don't have proof of it. And even in the worst days of the Soviet gulag, you know, Solzhenitsyn wrote in Siberia, in the gulag, and got his work out. So it's a very special place in that regard. So it's a land without a voice in for those 20 million. For the 3 million people in the capital, the rules are all different. You know, they have a three-tiered system. The people at the top have the internet. Show me someone in Pyongyang who's not seen the movie Titanic. Just point that person out. In fact, there's one foreign correspondent right now. She's an AP journalist. Her name's Jean Lee. She's of Korean descent, though she's American. And she's in Pyongyang, and she has an office. And she has five cub North Korean journalists working for her. She's trying to teach them all journalism and trying to write stories and is battling the state over everything she writes. She came through Stanford early this year, and she, you know, gave of her time, and I had lunch with her. She said right now, so many South Korean soap operas are making it again to the North that the hip thing is to have a South Korean accent, because that is a subtle way of suggesting to people that you have access to information from the outside world, right? So, you know, there's just two different systems there. Do they have French literature is a question. I would say... I'll tell an anecdote. When I went to North Korea, we had minders with us the whole time. And there were five of them. And the main one was a woman. She was so fantastic. She was so smart, so bright, so witty, great sense of humor, perfect American English idiom. Perfect. And she was everything but worldly. And when we would go around Pyongyang, she'd be like, yeah, my children were born in that hospital. She was like, yeah, I'm the best American minder. You know, she says, when the Americans come through, they call me. you know. I really love her pride and self-possession, actually. But the thing, she knew every fact about the world, let me say that. She knew all the continents, the countries, the lakes, the rivers, the train systems. She knew what a 747 was, though she'd never left North Korea. But she didn't know its essence, because she didn't have access, in my belief, to literature, to real cinema, to history, to sociology, to travel. I mean, what do you know about, like, Paris or London? It's from all the movies and the books and from talking to people, from the histories. And you build this cultural portrait. And I think that's what she was lacking. And right at the end, I just had a tiny test for her. And I didn't want to get anyone in trouble. But we were on a bus. We spent a lot of time on this little bus with a exhaust leak. And you know, and I can't know what's in her mind. It's illegal for a citizen of North Korea to interact with a foreigner. So the one place in the world you cannot talk to a North Korean is in North Korea. If you were even seen trying to, you would get a person in great trouble. And so I was only allowed to speak with these minders, and I didn't attempt to speak with anyone else. And I didn't want to get her in trouble, because the minders of the minders came in to mind them. And her family was at risk. She could lose her apartment if she failed at something. So, but I did say to her, just on the last day, we were in a bus, and I said, you know, I'm thinking of making another trip after this. Do you think I should go to Paris or to Mogadishu? That was my question to her. And she knew these were both world capitals, right? But we have different associations with the two, right? What are your associations?
Black Hawk Down.
Yeah. Do you like cheese? How many animal clips do you have, right? But she doesn't have access to those things, to real news, to all those things we use to build a portrait of a place. And I couldn't read her mind. She looked at me very blankly and smiled and said, depends on your travel plans. And I can't know her mind, but I inferred that she didn't really have a sense of those places. They were names to her. So, but North Korea is changing all the time. When you don't have rule of law and you have a dictator who says, iPads are legal this week, right? Everything can change on a moment's notice. And when I talk to people who've been there the year before me or the year after or last year, they all have much different experiences. Yeah. Marnie, how are we doing on time? Okay?
Maybe one more question.
Okay, this is going to be
two short ones.
Let's do two short ones. I'll ask this gentleman and then this person right behind. Yes.
Growing up, what was the favorite book or author that inspired you to become a writer?
Oh. I wasn't a big reader growing up. I think I did read as much as normal people. I didn't really discover literature really till college. And I was an engineering major with bad grades. And my buddy, Craig Pike, I would go to him every semester. I was like dying in linear algebra. And I would say, Craig, give me the... He knew every easy A class at Arizona State University. I would say, dude, I got to have an easy A. And he'd be like, jazz appreciation. You know? And he'd be like, history of music. I took family studies, which you watched on videotapes. Every class he suggested. And one year he said, creative writing, buddy. The easiest A in the world. He said, you just barf up some deep stuff. Everybody talks about how great you are, you know, and you go home. And if I had like one epiphany in life, it was going into a creative writing class. I come from a family of storytellers, and I don't know if I valued that properly. But I was a C student my whole life, you know, and I didn't care. And but in a creative writing class, like all of my perceived flaws that they'd sent notes home to my mom always, right? Adam's a rubbernecker. He's a daydreamer. He doesn't apply himself. You know, he's a liar. Even worse, he's an exaggerator. Like all these things people had said about me combined to make a great story. Like those things, like the real me was really valued in a story, and I had never felt like satisfied that way until I wrote my first story. So, yeah. And yes.
So the piece of propaganda that I found the most heartbreaking was the idea that elderly went to this retirement home that was beautiful and everybody believed it, and even people, the character, the actress, the capital, believed this. So
right.
Is that sense of propaganda also believed in
yes.
the capital and out in the country, or is there a difference there?
Yes. It's hard to know what, it was hard for me to know in Pyongyang what people believed. Because I couldn't really speak to them, even my minders. They had been, there's a college degree about handling foreigners, you know. It's a different kind of place. There is a minister of mass mobilization, and I did see him sweep human beings up off the street and put them in dump trucks and send them to the countryside. It was harvest season when I went, and everybody had to help. But in terms of, where was I? The piece of propaganda about the retirement homes. In the book, it's suggested that when you retire, you disappear to a place called Wonsan, and it's going to be very happy. Wonsan is a real sea town on the eastern coast of North Korea. It's not filled with retired people or people who were sent to gulags. It's a working town. But I wanted to capture a couple things. One, when I went to North Korea, there was a main minder, and she was really cool. Like, she was so hip. She knew how to, I would, like, listen to a song on my iPad, and she'd be like, scroll, scroll, scroll. Oh, click. Like, when I took a picture she didn't like, she'd work through the wheel of my Canon 60D. She'd be like, and she'd point at the trash can button. And when I was done, she'd scroll forward and back and see that I had deleted it. She was really hip. But she had a sidekick who was fresh out of the academy. And he wore a black tie and short-sleeved white shirts. He looked kind of like a Mormon missionary. And he really thought communist theory was awesome. And if we talked long enough, that I would convert. And he had all these little tricks he just learned. And he admitted it was his first thing. And he would say to me, there were a lot of long bus trips. And he would say, what do you think of terrorism? I would say, I think it's bad. And he would say, let me tell you what Kim Jong-il thinks of terrorism. And then he'd have these tracks that he had memorized word for word that just went on forever, and there was no stopping him. But one of the things he had that he gave me and then took back, because I couldn't keep it because maybe it was the only one he had, was a little pamphlet. And it was, you know, when you're there, he was like, oh, you're in workers' paradise. Oh, we have 100% democracy. Oh, we have universal health care. Too bad about your health care, you know. And but he had this pamphlet, and it was proof of the workers' paradise. And it was a pamphlet, and it was a beach town. There was a picture of a beach, and there were pictures of little huts. And he said, this is where our North Koreans go to vacation. Our vacations are free. How about your vacations? And I would say, well, I pay for mine. He said, well, they're here, they're free, because it's workers' paradise. And, you know, there were like six or eight huts on a beach. And I was like, where is this? And he said, it's a town near Wonsan. And I said, yeah, okay. And it was very beautiful white beaches. And I said, so all North Koreans go to this? He says, oh, yes. Every North Korean gets 2 weeks a year at this place. And I said, like 20 million people get 2 weeks a year at this place. And he said, oh, yes. I said, isn't it crowded? He'd never even considered this, you know, and he took it back. But that someone had concocted this and asked me to believe it, and I didn't know if he believed it or not. Like, I tried to capture this mindset. It's epistemological. It's people seeing the world differently, and I tried to capture it through that detail. But when you're in the Capitol, the worst thing I did was ask questions in the Capitol. There's four shoe factories in North Korea, and all the men wear one of four shoes. And I wanted to, the main one is kind of a Gilligan's Keds looking shoe. And I was like, what's the name of that shoe? Because I needed it for my book. And she didn't like that question. I asked where the fire stations were, because we've been driving around Pyongyang for 4 days, and I noticed, you know, I didn't see a fire station. And what did she tell me? They hadn't had a fire in 12 years, she said. I asked her where the mailboxes were. you know, she said, we have a perfect mail system. I was like, yeah, where are the mailboxes? And she says, it's utterly flawless. I was like, yeah, when I want to get a letter from one person to another person, how do I do it? And she was like, it's you know, you don't need to worry about that because it works great. There are no handicapped people in the Capitol that I saw driving around the capital of a nation. I didn't see one person in a wheelchair in a week, which was disturbing. And there's a shocking lack of older people in the Capitol. It's just a fact. When you get to a certain age, they want the Capitol to look beautiful, like a movie set. They import all the beautiful people from the countryside. And it's true. They're really concerned about that image. And the last straw, this really was... I mean, like, we went to see the gigantic statue of Kim Il-sung. 60-foot bronze. Now Kim Jong-il's next to it. But there was a sewer lid on the square, and it was the most beautiful, like, sewer lid I ever saw. It had, like, the Cholima horse flying on it and all these Hangul characters. And I asked her, I was like, it was like going to the Vatican, and there's the Pope. And I'm like, what does the sewer lid say? You know, she was so offended. But the last straw was... It struck me that all the women in Pyongyang had the exact same shade of lipstick on. And it's hard to think about how disconcerting that is, to see that same swipe, that swath on the variety of humanity. But I kind of loved it too, because I was like, I needed to know the name of that color. What did she call it? And I asked her, I said, what is the name of that lipstick? You know? And, like all the men, there were only 5 haircuts for a male that are state approved in North Korea, but only 3 of them were in fashion. And she told me that all the men were wearing the speed battle haircut, the number 2. So she didn't mind that. But when I asked her what was the name of the lipstick that all women were forced to wear, it was a moment of deep shame. And you could tell she felt horrible. She knew that women around the world got to wear different kinds of things and that she was forced to wear this. And she just grimaced and stared at me. So... You know, the lack of old people and that little pamphlet came together to make Wonsan. I'd be happy to inscribe your books, answer questions, and talk in person. Thank you for coming out tonight. Yeah.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.